From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. We don't ever want to miss an opportunity to tell you how much you mean to us. For more information on how you can keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Thursday is the Christian Feast of Michael and All Angels, as well as the Ethiopian Orthodox Christian Observance of Mezcal. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, what began as a peaceful prayer vigil after the police shooting death of a black man in Charlotte, North Carolina, devolved into another night of violence this week, as community outrage over that tragedy, as well as similar killings in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Columbus, Ohio, renewed the sense of dread and fear so many members of minority communities continue to live with every day. Solutions to this ongoing crisis are going to be excruciatingly difficult to find. But there are two quotations that stayed with me from the week's news coverage that warn of how far apart we are when it comes to race. The first words were radioed from a Tulsa police helicopter moments before Pastor Terrence Crutcher was gunned down next to his broken-down car. Quote, "That looks like a bad dude." The second was circulated widely on social media, attributed to UCC pastor Tracy Blackman, quote, "It's impossible to be unarmed when my blackness is the weapon you fear." A former Florida county clerk has filed suit charging discrimination in her firing. She had refused to issue marriage license to same-sex couples, citing her religious conscience as an ordained Christian minister. Ironically, Yannicka Parker cites several Bible verses in her lawsuit to bolster her case that God forbids marriage equality, apparently not noticing that one of those verses also commands women to remain silent and bans them from ministry. And the Fraternal Order of Police endorsed Donald Trump for president earlier this month. His unmeasured public response to the Tulsa police shooting has some FOP members saying the group may have been too quick to pull the trigger. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
We are having this amazing event coming up on September 25th called the Concert Across America to End Gun Violence. This is a concert that's being sponsored by States United. It's all of the different independent state-based gun violence prevention organizations working together to put on a concert at the same time on the same day, September 25th.
The intractable deadlock over firearms in this country calls for creative and innovative approaches. One attempt at a different approach is happening this Sunday with the Concert Across America to End Gun Violence. You'll meet Menachem Creditor, founder of Rabbis Against Gun Violence.
Voter suppression and news suppression have to go together because you've got to keep it quiet. Right?
The book was a New York Times bestseller during the Bush administration. So why is investigative journalist Greg Palast releasing his The Best Democracy Money Can Buy this week as a film? Trust me, it's not a historical picture. And Greg will be back with us later in this week's show.
Hillary Clinton is a bigot.
Donald Trump has built his campaign on prejudice and paranoia.
I've been thinking a lot about the moral aspects of the presidential campaign. There are regular outrages on the right that defy understanding. But it occurs to me that the ineffectiveness of the Democratic campaign to effectively articulate a compelling, values-driven vision is, in a year like this, also bordering on being a moral failure. I was literally longing for voices like those of William Barmer, Simone Campbell, and Elizabeth Warren to be more prominent in the national campaign. And while that may not happen, it was heartening this week to hear about a courageous new campaign from NETWRC, a Catholic lobby for social justice, titled the Presidential Bigotry Watch Project. And I am delighted that it brings Sister Simone Campbell, Executive Director of the NETWRC Lobby, back to State of Belief Radio. Simone, thanks for joining us again.
Oh, so glad to be with you. Thanks for lifting this up.
Now, I understand that today you are actually a nun on a train.
That's correct. I'm headed from Chicago to South Bend, chugging along on a little commuter train.
Simone, what made you decide to involve the sisters so directly in addressing bigotry in this campaign?
Well, quite frankly, Logan, we were shocked at the level of animosity, hatred, and downright lies that are being told in this campaign, mostly against people of color or against immigrants. And at first I thought in the primary it would calm down once we got to the general election, but it's continued unabated. Mm-hmm. And my perspective is that if we do not stand up now and say, this is enough, stop it, mm-hmm. it's only going to get worse. And as a person of faith, I know there is a requirement that we include all in our care. And when we act outside of that requirement, that we're doing harm to ourselves and harm to our nation, harm to our world. And that is wrong. And so at NETWRC, we felt that if we didn't stand up now, when would we stand up? Mm-hmm. It's not a time for weakness at all. It's a time to be clear and engaged. And that's what we're trying to do.
Would you give a couple of examples of what you're on the lookout for?
Oh, absolutely. Let me give you our first example. I thought maybe once we, you know, decided to do this, then the candidates would shape up. But just a couple of days ago, the Trump campaign tweeted out that the Syrian refugees were like a bowl of Skittles. Mm-hmm. And that if you knew one could kill you, would you take the bowl? And the whole idea was that these were people who were seen as just a bowl of candy, not suffering people fleeing war, mm-hmm. who are engaged in a struggle for their lives, and that cavalier disregard of the suffering of our people said to us, this is wrong. Mm-hmm. This is wrong in a national debate. We need to honor the dignity of all people. Now, I do it because of faith, but the fact is, the Constitution does the same thing when it says we need to be honoring all of us. And it's unacceptable that people that are vying for national leadership mm-hmm. would so disregard the dignity of people.
Right.
It's wrong.
Right. I can't help but think of an example, and I want to ask if this is the kind of thing you're talking about as well, that for candidate Trump to be saying that African Americans are worse off today than they've ever been in our nation. That is a stunning statement.
It is. And the thing that I find quite disheartening is his effort to say anything to any audience mm-hmm. and without a solid sense of a center for him.
Uh-huh.
And that kind of statement belies history, but tries to play on the current unrest, the current reality of racism that continues to live in our society, albeit a significant step beyond slavery, a significant step beyond abject poverty, a significant step in the progress we've made over the years, but we have a long way to go. So he, it appears, just made makes these cavalier comments trying to garner support without any basis in fact.
Right. It's a tricky thing to do this kind of watchdog work under the auspices of a nonprofit organization. And I would like for you to talk about how you address this particular challenge, because some people, as you well know, are going to say, well, that's just outright partisanship.
Right. Well, one of the things is our organization network is both a charitable organization, a C3 under tax purposes, and a C4, a lobby organization. So we're doing this work in our lobby organization.
Sure.
But I do value that we maintain a balanced perspective. But in this instance, we are watching both candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Now, fortunately, both candidates don't do this sort of outrageous behavior. And for the most part, while we watch every Clinton speech or actually tweets are the big thing these days, while we watch all that, we don't expect to see as much, but if we do, we're going to call it out.
Mm-hmm.
But the other piece is, Weldon, is that I think we have this false sense of equivalency, this false sense that, oh, they're both even, they're both the same.
Mm-hmm.
They're not.
Right.
And if we, people of faith with a strong, what I think is a strong moral compass, don't speak from our perspective, our people are lost. Our people don't have leadership. And so, quite frankly, yes, there's some worry about, well, are we really being, kind of balanced, fair and balanced news, bipartisan? Yes, we are. But the other fact is we've got to speak out when this atrocious behavior continues, regardless of the fact that it might be uncomfortable for some or uncomfortable for us.
Right.
But that's the moral mandate of the gospel for me.
How do you speak out? So you hear something in one of the campaigns that just sends chills down your spine and makes you want to jump and say, surely they didn't say that. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, we're trying to engage the Trump campaign. So, yes, we do tweets and a social media campaign to call out the bigotry, but we're also trying to say to them directly, it's unacceptable, and to let them know that anyone who's seeking the highest office in the land needs to be respectful and responsible in their words, in their actions, and in their policies. So we do send emails and letters to the campaign. I have to say we haven't gotten a response, but we are trying to engage them directly, as well as in the social media and Twitter world. The irony is that it does appear that the Trump campaign pays more attention to the Twitter world than to the other forms of engagement. So we're going to continue trying to engage them.
Simone, I'd like for you to respond to the thought that I shared during the introduction to this segment. I think, and I've been thinking about it a lot, that there is a moral component across the board in this election. We've been talking about Donald Trump a lot. I think there is a moral component to the failure of the Clinton campaign to engage progressives on a values level, a values level. Am I being too hard on them to say that?
No, I agree. I mean, the problem is the scriptures say, without a vision, the people perish, and our people are perishing. I mean, the Clinton campaign has a lot of smarts, a lot of good policy, but it's the lack of a comprehensive vision of we the people that is really, I think, hurting the campaign tremendously. And the other day I was at the Ford Foundation, and a guy who identified himself as non-religious said, well, it seems like the progressives really kind of need a moral voice, but unless you're a faith person, you can't speak with a moral voice. The progressives don't have a moral way of doing analysis. And I thought that was really interesting, and why we as people of faith are needed on both sides of the aisle to make sure that the bedrock values of the value and dignity of each person, the dignity of creation, and our right to food, shelter, clothing, education, health care, those bedrock values need to be lifted up at this moment. And quite frankly, I am disappointed that the Clinton campaign hasn't addressed it at that level and continues at the more detailed policy level. So I have to say, the other day, Secretary Clinton had an op-ed in the New York Times about the issue of poverty and children struggling in poverty that I thought began to touch on it. I hope she lifts that up some more.
Tell us what other work Network Lobby is doing between now and Election Day to ensure that a social justice agenda is not lost in the noise of this campaign.
Well, I'm traveling extensively around the country, giving talks, and we're doing a lot of social media around our seven Mend the Gap strategies: tax justice, living wage, family-friendly workplace. But then we also know that all of our people need access to democracy, the right to vote. We have to make sure that all of our people can vote, that there's access to health care, access to citizenship, which means immigration reform, and access to housing. So what we're doing is we've got up on our website these videos side-by-side comparing the two candidates for president on these seven issues. And folks can go to our networklobby.org website /election and see our videos side-by-side, just setting out briefly what the candidates say about how they stand on our seven policies. And then we end with, well, you decide who's best for our nation. That effort is we're taking especially to low-income communities to turn out the vote, and hoping that through prayer and engagement, we will be able to get a engaged public that will vote on November 8th.
Sister Simone Campbell is Executive Director of the Network Lobby for Catholic Social Justice. This week, the sisters launched the Presidential Bigotry Watch Project with the slogan, "Bigotry is a bad habit." Sister Simone is the author of the book, A Nun on the Bus, How All of Us Can Create Hope, Change, and Community. You can follow her work at networklobby.org, and you can find those issues she was talking about and the comparisons there. Simone, it's always great to speak with you. Yeah, safe travels, and thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
It was back in 2002 that investigative journalist Greg Palast pulled back the curtain on the financial fun and games underpinning our electoral system with the publication of the best-selling book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. In the intervening years, Greg has done invaluable work around race, voter disenfranchisement, and political dirty tricks. Meanwhile, the nation has gotten the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling. Well, this past week, a new film bearing the title of that important book opened in New York City and other markets, and Greg is back with us to talk about this important new project. Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
What a thrill. I'm quite honored to be with you, and yes, we have worldwide openings in Hollywood, New York, and real America.
Good. Is this new film based on your book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy?
It's based on the new updated Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which is just hitting the bookstands this week. And it has some of those old films. Back in the original Best Democracy Money Can Buy, for example, I uncovered how Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris removed thousands of black people from the voter rolls of Florida, saying that they were criminals, felons, who not allowed to vote. Every single one of those people were innocent, except for the crime of voting while black. Well, the new film and book includes that, but we've all updated it to, unfortunately, the new apartheid voting tricks of this year. It's an informative film. It's an important film, but it's a very entertaining film. In fact, we do the Great Felon Con as a kind of Saturday morning cartoon, which is embedded in the film. We have lots of cartoons because we are using the same artist who drew Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And so you get a lot of Roger Rabbit effects and lots of super hijinks and seeing how we actually do our investigative reports. So you get more than just the information. This is kind of a real live detective story. It's a detective spy thriller kind of thing where you actually follow me on my investigations for Rolling Stone, the latest tricks in trying to steal the 2016 election before it's stolen.
Greg, talk about what you're warning viewers about in this film.
I'm warning viewers that there's some billionaires out there who would like some more billions, and they're willing to spend a lot of money to take away your vote. And what the easiest thing for them to do is steal minority votes. Weldon, you heard Donald Trump say this election's rigged, and he should know because his buddies are rigging it. And here's how they're rigging it this time. And I'm not giving anything away from the film because there's so many stories in the film, lots of fun, and lots of terrifying things, too, if you care about America, which is, for example, Donald Trump says that there are people voting many, many times. That's how it's going to be rigged. Well, what that is accusing people voting many times of which people, I found out, it's not just Trump talking through his comb-over. He's got Republican operators, including the guy who is his immigration, you know, his Mexico wall specialist, who put together lists of voters that they are accusing of voting twice. It's not a small list, Weldon. There are 7 million names on their suspect list. And it would be a joke. It would be insane, except that these lists are shared by 30 Republican secretaries of state, the people in charge of the vote in states like Ohio, North Carolina, Louisiana, Mississippi, Arizona. So you're talking about the swing states. You're talking about the states with the big Senate races that will determine the Senate. And they are basically removing voters from the voter rolls on grounds that they voted twice or registered illegally twice in two different states. Now, if you rob a bank, they don't close your bank account. They throw you in jail. Here they're taking away people's votes who are supposedly committing a felony crime, but they don't arrest them. Why don't they just go out and arrest 7 million people if they really committed this crime? And the answer, and they don't arrest anyone. Why? Because they didn't commit the crime. Their only crime is having a common name, and common names are most common in America to black voters, you know, like James Brown, who they say voted 288 times in Georgia. Instead of saying, hey, that's just a common black name, they said, no, it's the same guy. Their only evidence is first and last name match. That's it. That is it. Junior and senior, father and son, same voter. Middle name mismatches. 2 million of the names on their list, those names don't match. And by the way, if you're wondering how I know this, because they won't give anyone the list. You know, if you know Greg Pallas, I'm an investigative reporter. So you're in the film, you see how I go about getting these confidential lists and busting their game.
Greg, there is so much wrong in this election season that it's difficult to know where to focus. Is what you've just been talking about your major focus this time around, or is it even broader than that?
It's both.
Yeah.
The major focus of the investigation in the film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, the core investigation is on this accusation that people are voting many, many times by Donald Trump because we expect it to remove 1 million names from the voter rolls. Virginia removed 41,000 people. The swing state of North Carolina removed 35,000 people. Looks like Ohio's already removed 50,000 voters. Not arresting anyone for double voting, just accusing them. And that's the swing margin in these swing states. But when you say, am I looking wider? Yeah, I'm looking at, in the film, we go through many of the tricks put in the way of voters, especially minority voters, and student voters, young voters, military vote. That they get in the way of. And then, but there's something else. The subtitle of the film and the subtitle of the updated book, of the Best Democracy Money Can Buy. The subtitle is A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. And the billionaires are the core of the investigation. That's the second thing I do in the film. I find out the billionaires behind the scam. You wouldn't be surprised to know that the Koch brothers are involved, but I have something that no one else has, because I've been investigating these guys 20 years. I have a secret tape recording of Billy Koch ratting on his two brothers, David and Charles, explaining how they've actually committed felony crimes. This is no joke. So I've got that tape. We play it in the film. And then I go after the other billionaires, including, for example, the number one, the richest guy behind Donald Trump. Now, people say, I thought he was funding his own campaign. Well, the problem for Trump is that he just plays a billionaire on television. He doesn't have $1 billion. His hotels are hocked up to his eyeballs.
Mm-hmm.
So behind him is a guy known as JP, JP the Foreclosure King, a guy who made $5 billion, one person, $5 billion in a single year by crashing the mortgage market. When the mortgage market crashed, this guy gave it an extra shove over a cliff and made $5 billion. And he is using that to fund the Trump campaign, not Donald Trump. And you get to meet this guy because I confront him. It's not easy. I have to chase him around the country and then finally catch up with him by kind of working my way into a $1,000 plate Hamptons dinner party in New York. And by the way, to do that stuff, I have, for example, a camera hidden in my hat.
Well, Greg, I believed you. Why aren't we hearing this on mainstream news?
You tell me. I mean, well, I do report on mainstream news. That is, I'm a reporter for the BBC Nightly News. That's the biggest mainstream in the planet, and for the Guardian newspaper, the number one English-language paper, but not in America, because America's out of the mainstream of world news. So while I'm at the top of the nightly news everywhere, in fact, I was just on prime time in Germany with this story.
Mm-hmm.
So why isn't it on prime time in, say, Florida? That's a good question. And I was just in Rolling Stone, so I can kind of sneak in through a rock and roll magazine, right? So Rolling Stone. It is shameful because America does not want to face the fact that we still have apartheid voting. That 50 years after Martin Luther King crossed the bridge at Selma and won the Voting Rights Act, which we're all properly proud of as a nation, that it was rolled back, and we're rolling back. In fact, the film ends in Selma because a black man who walked across the bridge at Martin Luther King 50 years ago as a young man became the state senator representing Selma, which is a tremendous advance. It's one of the great things about America that we made this great advance to end our own system of apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
But now, he called me up. I came down to tell him. He says, my name has been removed from the voter roll. He's the senator. He's the senator, and he got his name knocked off the voter roll. So I began investigating in Alabama. And so once again, we're having all these tricks, and we just, you know, we have to kind of march over the bridge again. We have to keep doing it.
Now, you mentioned the motivation of this in the Trump campaign. Is it just on the Republican side, or is this across the board?
Well, at the moment, remember, not many years back, when Martin Luther King crossed that bridge, he was fighting the Democratic Party, which was the party of Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
So it was mostly Democrats who were blocking the black vote. Today, it's mostly Republican. Why? Because black people vote Democratic, and it's a cheap way to get rid of your opponent's votes is by accusing black people of voting twice or accusing Hispanics of not being American citizens, a trick used in Florida and in Arizona. We show that in the film, again, in a cartoon form. Unfortunately, you know, it's used as a political weapon, and unfortunately it's often used by both parties. One of the great ironies, and you'll see it in the book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, with the new edition just coming out now, is that, for example, the Democratic Party of New Mexico, headed by two Hispanics at the time, Bill Richardson and his Secretary of State, Hispanic Democrats, they mass disenfranchised other Hispanic Democrats because a guy like Bill Richardson could never win a primary in New Mexico if every Mexican-American voted.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, disenfranchisement, which is a fancy word for stealing your vote,
mm-hmm.
happens both parties are guilty. Right now, the Republicans are using computers, and they're better at it, and they're doing it on a mass basis. But, you know, the Democrats have really dirty hands on this, and so it's hard for them to take up arms over this because they're involved. So you can't expect the Democratic Party to save these people because they play so many of these games themselves. It's really that's a great tragedy. We have to defend ourselves, not hope for the political parties to do it for us.
Greg, regardless of which party prevails at the ballot box, who do you see as the likely winners this November?
Where most of the billionaires, remember I'm tracking billionaires throughout the film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and they're more concerned about the down ballot, as they call it, the Senate races. The United States Senate is truly up for grabs, and these tricks are concentrating in those hot Senate race states, Arizona, Ohio, New Hampshire, Florida, Arizona. These are the states where this trickery is hot and heavy. And I go to these states in this film and confront some of these officials, like North Carolina, which is truly the probably the swing state of swing states. And I said, you've removed 35,000 people of voter rolls for voting twice. Why don't you arrest them? And they actually said to me, well, it's hard to find them. I said, they're registered to vote. You have their address. So I actually went out. I personally went out to go grab some of these people and confronted them. You know, and they, like, for example, one guy I go to, his name is Donald Alexander Webster Jr. And he's supposed to be the same guy who voted as Donald Eugene Webster Sr. And so he says, how could I be the same guy? And I said, but that's what the government says. You're losing your vote because of that. I said, you're lucky that they don't arrest you. Of course they won't arrest him because then the whole scam would be exposed.
Okay, we want to see the film. How can we see it? How can we share it with like-minded people?
There's a couple ways. Number one, we now have the regular distributor, and if you're in San Francisco and New York and Washington and L.A. and et cetera, you'll be able to go walk into a theater and get your popcorn the easy way. Then we're going to have video on demand. You can download The Best Democracy Money Can Buy or get a disc, a DVD. But we also have something very interesting called Gather. If you go to gregpalast.com, that's G-R-E-G-P-A-L-A-S-T, gregpalast.com, you can say, I want a showing in my town. It could be, you know, Baton Rouge. It can be Little Rock. It can be, you know, Vegas, whatever. And we have a deal with a distribution company that they will do one-time screenings. It doesn't mean you're renting the theater or you're obligated or anything. You just say, I know I want this film, and I know that I can get people to join with me. I have a group. I have a church. I have an organization. I have a posse of some type, and, we think we can fill a little theater house. And they will ask you, what theaters do you like in your area? And they will arrange to have a showing at the theater you choose. And it doesn't cost you anything to arrange any of this. Just go in and buy a ticket and have your popcorn. But it's a very good way to get people together. And because it's a single showing, you get like-minded people or interested people who like entertainment, too. I wouldn't ask you to see a film that's not entertaining. Sure. It's not PBS. It's not a good-for-you film. It is a real movie with Rosario Dawson and Willie Nelson and Ice-T and Richard Belzer and Santa Claus, played by Ed Asner. So it's kind of a combination of a kind of fun movie and a detective movie and a documentary, that is, because there's nonfiction. It's really happening, and a lot of it is investigation as we're doing it. But the important thing is go to gregpalast.com, and we're setting up to show it in about 200 cities.
Greg Palast is a best-selling author and investigative journalist. His new film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, opened in New York last week and is expanding to more cities as we speak. Greg, I'm always scared by what you tell us is going on in the nation that so many people don't know about, but I'm always inspired by the way you go after these people and these situations. So thanks for taking a few minutes of a very busy week for State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Weldon. I'll see you at the movies.
with terror attacks and police shootings dominating the headlines, the ongoing epidemic of gun violence has once again receded from the spotlight. But with far more lives lost in this country to firearms in the hands of civilians than either of those other categories, it's vital, vital to keep up the pressure for meaningful change. One ambitious attempt to do just that is taking form this Sunday as the Concert Across America to End Gun Violence. One sponsoring organization is Rabbis Against Gun Violence, and I am happy to welcome founder and chair Menachem Creditor to State of Belief Radio. Rabbi Creditor, thanks for being with us on this show.
Thanks for having me.
Please describe, if you would, the Concert Across America.
Well, the Concert Across America is an intentional gathering beyond borders, beyond any one genre of music or faith community, to bring together music to make a big difference in our cultural statements around gun violence. It's clear that we have more than one voice, more than one way of expressing ourselves, and yet we are all equally vulnerable to the ravages of gun violence. And so there are communities that are singing wordless melodies. There are communities lifting their voices in traditional prayers or in songs. And there are artists of all kinds joining together in more than 250 places of worship in America and concerts outside of houses of faith. I think it's a swelling up of a lot of hurt people lifting their voices in song and in mourning.
Rabbi, where did this idea originate?
Well, there were actually a number of different sponsoring organizations, and I think it was actually a grassroots attempt on the part of lots of organizations. You can look on the website, concertacrossamerica.org, to see how many people came together. And I got to say, having been part of organizing for quite some time, the point of origin is usually hard to pinpoint, but when it comes together in such a coherent way, I think, you know, as a person of faith, I would say that the origin point is God, and mm-hmm. we all heard it really differently.
Yeah. What are your expectations? How do you want to get to people through this concert that for some reason we've not been able to engage before now?
Well, I think it's possible and probable, and this is, you know, true for us who are on the forefront of this specific effort, to lose hope. I think it is really, really hard to see the ravages of gun violence, to see the different versions of it. In North Carolina and Tulsa, you know, this week and across the country, to see the rage when it comes to different forms of gun violence, be they mass attacks, be they urban gun violence, be they suicide. It is really hard to endure this kind of loss and tragedy and endless tragedy. And so from the concert, my real hope, my deepest expectation, is that we can support each other and gain momentum and gain hope. It is clear that there's a consensus in America about things like background checks mm-hmm. that the government has failed us on so far. But it is also clear from doing this work that we are just sad a lot because of all of these losses.
Mm-hmm.
To see the image of God erased time after time, it takes some singing to resurrect the faith within each of us and as a community of activists so that we can preserve life.
Tell us about your organization.
Sure. Rabbis Against Gun Violence is fairly new on the scene. There are a lot of rabbis who have been active but didn't gather together as rabbis. So we founded this group a little bit less than a year ago, and we have 1,100 faith activists around America, most of whom are rabbis, many of whom are Jewish leaders, who have contributed writings and sermons and been part of legislative lobbying. And we have been now part of a large coalition with groups like Moms Demand Action and Everytown and Faith United Against Gun Violence. We've connected with other Jewish organizations, but we are the only Jewish organization in America that is solely dedicated to ending gun violence.
How big a swath in Judaism do you have in your membership? Are there conservative Jews or Orthodox Jews or progressive Jews? What kind of mixture do you have?
Sure. I have to say it's a unifying group. I was blown away by the intensity of support, how quickly our traction grew, both in Facebook groups and email lists and in gatherings and teachings. We put out a book with 62 voices from different parts of the Jewish world and a few outside of the Jewish world. The book is called Not by Might. And we have, I'm a conservative rabbi, and we have renewal, reconstructionist, conservative, Orthodox, independent, and unaffiliated. It seems to me that it would be hard to say anything other than words of Kaddish, words of mourning, words of protest, words of life from within Jewish tradition. And so I don't see a stream of Judaism that would oppose our message, even if we have nuanced visions of how to activate the idea of ending gun violence.
Mm-hmm. Do I understand correctly that you formed the organization?
I did. The earliest version of the group didn't have the title Rabbis Against Gun Violence. It was a different, more ad hoc group that formed after the Sandy Hook massacre, where I was invited to lead a Jewish delegation as part of an interfaith delegation connected with the PICO network to the White House, where we met with the staff of the vice president and delivered a statement to heal America from the ravages of gun violence. That group remained fairly small, and then as time went on, we gained more and more people. And then around the time of President Obama's town hall, earlier in the spring last year, we renamed the group Rabbis Against Gun Violence, and I recruited a few different members and friends to be on the executive leadership team and to be a co-chair. So now we have representation nationwide. We went from a group of 50 about a year ago to a group of a little bit more than 1,100 now.
Do you welcome into your organization people who are not Jewish or maybe people who are not even oriented toward religion?
Yes, of course. Of course. Look, my general worldview is even if you don't use the word God to describe your soul, I do. Mm-hmm. And I don't need us to agree for me to see God's image in your eyes.
Hmm.
And so this work that we do is not Jews for Jews. This work that we do is wielding and leveraging the power of Jewish tradition and faith in general to preserve everyone's life. So we would, I think, be doing a disservice to our own mandate if we limited our membership.
How do you promote your agenda?
Every way we can. I think we are all trying to figure out how in this media landscape that is blinding and deafening with ignorance and with a news cycle that feeds itself, and then with the intransience of even progressive leaders on issues of gun violence, I think it's hard to figure out how to penetrate the consciousness of America. So what I would say is we sing and we pray and we march and we talk and we weep and we certainly use technology. So social media and organizing is certainly a part of this. The national coordinator for Rabbis Against Gun Violence, a dear friend and teacher of mine, Arlene Sofer, has written articles and has been very active, as have I. So one of the ways that we do it is by just being rabbis, being the faith leaders that we are, emphatically dedicated to the task. And each of us has a different encatchment. So I have a community here in California of about 400 families, and I have a social media presence which is larger than that. And so I think we are just trying to find the best way to communicate with all the passion we can, and also trying to find a listening ear to those who disagree so we can find a way forward together.
Menachem, how can listeners learn more about the concert as well as about Rabbis Against Gun Violence?
Sure. Thank you for asking. One of the ways I would suggest people find out more is to visit rabbisagainstgunviolence.org, where there are links to all of the work that we do, including our connection with the concert. The concert's website is called concertacrossamerica.org, and you can find out more there. One of our partners that has really spearheaded the work is Faiths United, so that's faithsunited.org. So those three websites are great, and on Facebook you can find the Rabbis Against Gun Violence webpage. We have some information that we share there as well.
You know, I think I'm not speaking for just myself, because I've heard implicit in so much of what you've said already There are many of us been passionate for a long time about trying to get this matter of gun regulation under control. And we, I think our hopes rise and fall. I could not help but think about the context in which we're doing the interview today, and we're seeing this past week in our nation again the use of guns in a very uncivil and deadly way that hurts a lot of people. What keeps you going? What is it that gets you up in the morning to do this again when we find so many disappointments and losses?
Yeah, I think that's the big question. I wake up very grateful for my children, and I wake up very afraid for the world in which my children live. And I see all of these passionate people, despite the horrors on our streets, the blood that literally is crying up from the ground. And I look at my community, people who affirm life and are dedicated to living a life of faith outside the boundary of our sanctuary. I take hope in each other. I take hope in the work that you're doing, amplifying the work that we're doing. There is so much good to do that I wake up, and I know that it's actually not a choice I'm allowed to make. I don't wake up wondering if I'm going to do this work. I wake up knowing this is the work I was called to do. Mm-hmm. And in moments when I am weary, I turn to people I love and who love me. And we cry a lot, and we hold each other, and we get strong again, and then we get back to work.
Hmm. Rabbi Menachem Creditor is founder and chair of Rabbis Against Gun Violence. The organization is one of the sponsors of this Sunday's Concert Across America to End Gun Violence. Rabbi Creditor, I really am so grateful for what you're doing. I love your attitude about it and your devotion to it. And I really appreciate you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here with you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show, as I have, it's something that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that's grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online. You can be a part of that. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. Could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.